Welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. Today we'll look at a number of subjects in the news. We'll begin in a moment and speak with Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson, who was Secretary of State Colin Powell's Chief of Staff at the Department of State from August 2002 to January 2005. In October of 2005, Colonel Wilkerson, after considerable soul searching, went public to tell uncomfortable truths about the decision-making process at the highest levels in the Bush administration. As Iraq teeters on the cusp of a civil war, we'll be joined then by Wayne White, who's an adjunct scholar at Washington's Middle East Institute. He most recently served as the Deputy Director of the Bureau of Intelligence and Research Office of Analysis for the Near East and South Asia at the State Department. He also served as the State Department's Principal Iraq Analyst and Head of INR's Iraq Team from 2003 to 2005. And then he'll be joined by Dr. Mohammed Sahimi, who is a Professor and Chairman of Chemical Engineering at the University of Southern California in Los Angeles. He was educated in Iran and the United States and has been a faculty member at USC since 1984. In January of this year, Dr. Sahimi wrote a Los Angeles Times op-ed article co-authored with the 2003 Nobel Peace Prize laureate Shirin Ebadi entitled Diffusing Iran with Democracy. So we'll be looking into the possibility, since Iran's been referred to the IEA and this Security Council will be taking it up in the next couple of weeks, whether there is any possible leverage for democracy in that condition, as the United States and Iran hurl veiled threats and ultimatums at each other. I'm now speaking with Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson, who was Secretary of State Colin Powell's Chief of Staff at the Department of State from August 2002 to January 2005. Colonel Wilkerson's career with Colin Powell goes back to March of 1989 at the U.S. Army's Forces Command in Atlanta, Georgia, where Colonel Wilkerson was Colin Powell's Deputy Executive Officer. He followed Colin Powell to become his special assistant as Colin Powell was chairman of the U.S. Joint Chiefs of Staff. And upon Colin Powell's retirement from active service in 1983, Colonel Wilkerson served as the Deputy Director and Director of the United States Marine Corps War College at Quantico, Virginia. And he retired from active service in 1997. He then began working for Colin Powell in private capacity as a consultant and advisor. And then in December 2000, Secretary of State designate Colin Powell asked Colonel Wilkerson to join him in the transition office at the United States State Department. And upon his confirmation as Secretary of State, Secretary Powell moved Colonel Wilkerson to the policy planning staff with responsibility for East Asia and the Pacific. In June of 2002, the Director of Policy Planning, Ambassador Richard Haass, made Colonel Wilkerson the Associate Director. And in August of 2002, Secretary Powell moved Wilkerson to the position of Chief of Staff of the Department. And in October of 2005, Colonel Wilkerson, after considerable soul-searching, went public to tell uncomfortable truths about the inner workings of the Bush administration. And I guess amid the headlines, Colonel Wilkerson, about Vice President Cheney providing guidance that led to America's torture, disgrace in Guantanamo, Abu Ghraib, and elsewhere, and the reporting about Secretary Powell's February 2003 presentation at the United Nations as the lowest point in his life, what seems to have gotten perhaps overlooked in this is the extent to which I thought what you were trying to focus on and trying to provide the public with is the fact that this administration has not used the counsel, experience, and knowledge of the bureaucracies in Washington and in circumventing them. Do you believe at this point that they're paying the price?
I certainly do. I noted with some degree of encouragement this morning in the Outlook session of the Washington Post back here that David Rothkopf has written a piece. I'm using his textbook right now to teach from, his textbook on running the world, the latest book on the National Security Council process. And he says that in this recent article in the Outlook section of the Post that Dr. Rice has won and that Vice President Cheney and his crowd have been relegated to the woodwork and that we shall see a very, very different administration now over the next 3 years, if indeed we aren't already seeing it. I applaud that if it's true, but I await substance before I decide whether it's true or not.
But I was under the impression that Dr. Rice had in fact become the president's private tutor in the first 4 years, had not really, I mean, the National Security Advisor's principal job is basically the only person in the president's corner to protect the president, even as Henry Kissinger did with Nixon, protect him from himself. And you got the impression that in the first term she spent most of her time as his private tutor and was essentially rolled by the more experienced Cheney, Rumsfeld, as you described, cabal. And, of course, people should realize that it was, after all, Rumsfeld who brought Cheney into government. So it's a pretty tight bond there, is it not?
But I take David's point this morning in his piece in the Post because, let's face it, the Rumsfeld-Cheney cabal has brought disaster, unparalleled disaster, upon this administration. It is arguably now viewed across America as one of the most inept, incompetent administrations in American history. And I think probably one of the points David is trying to make is that even a president who needed tutoring for 4 years is smart enough to awaken to that fact. And I hope David's right. I hope that the Vice President and Secretary of Defense, David also says in his book that the thing that diminishes power most rapidly and most substantially is failure. Well, this administration's power should be diminished considerably because it's had nothing but failure.
And I did a long interview with David about his book where he had access to all of the previous National Security Advisors and key staff, and took us through the importance of the National Security Council. But just on following that point you made, Colonel Wilkerson, do you believe that President Bush himself, who has a reputation for being somewhat detached, does he recognize, because the impression one gets is that he doesn't get a broad input of information, and perhaps he's somewhat delusional about what's really happening in Iraq?
Well, I won't discount that entirely, although I do think David's point that it's diminished rapidly over this last 8 to 9 months because it's been very difficult to avoid the negative news. Even if you don't read the paper, even if you don't watch the television, even if you don't get your news from a wide spectrum of the bureaucracy, and even if the bureaucracy is being more or less sycophantic and not telling you the truth, still something has to seep through of the significance of the failure thus far in Iraq, and not just in Iraq. Let's take the January 2000 State of the Union address where the president very boldly identified the axis of evil, almost as if he were attempting to template words of the great communicator Ronald Reagan when he hurled the evil empire epithet at the Soviet Union, and by doing so falling into one of the classic traps history offers for decision makers, and that is you can't template the past for the present and the future. But nonetheless, let's look at 2002 and the axis of evil, and let's examine the axis of evil today. Disastrous failures on all three counts. Six-party talks, moribund and dead, with Pyongyang, North Korea making more nuclear weapons, not less. Iran, probably the biggest threat America confronts today, and with no apparent diplomatic initiatives of any substance left, we've forfeited all the opportunities to talk to Tehran when we had maximum leverage over them, for example. And Iraq. Iraq itself, which looked like low-hanging fruit on the axis of evil and easily taken out, has turned out to be a disaster. And the greatest winner from our failure in Iraq is Iran. Iran won the 15 December elections. She rid herself of her number one enemy in the region, Iraq, without firing a shot. She's reasserted her leadership over the radical Islamic world, leadership that bin Laden took over on 9/11 with Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. Iran stands right now to be the regional victor in our having invaded Baghdad. What a turn of events there.
Well, indeed, you could say that what our policies have done is, perhaps in terms of blowback, they have emboldened and strengthened the most virulent form of radical Shiism and the most virulent form of radical Sunniism.
Absolutely.
Ahmadinejad and al-Qaeda.
Absolutely. And exacerbated our own situation in our failure to recognize that this is fundamentally a war of ideas. And in invading Iraq, we contaminated our own ideas, everything from torture to the invasion in the first place. And if we have a struggle here, this struggle is with Islam itself in order to get the great mass of Islam more or less on our side, and against Al-Qaeda and Al-Qaeda-like organizations. And in that regard, we're losing. Iraq has probably turned out to be the greatest boon for recruiting bin Laden could have asked for.
Well, I think at this point, with Iraq teetering on the cusp of a civil war, if it takes the plunge, I don't think you can avoid a broader regional war. And given that the provocation recently with the bombing of the mosque in Samarra, that apparently, I didn't realize this, I talked to Bob Baer, the former CIA officer, last week about this. He said that Ahmadinejad is an apocalyptic Shia convert, and that he, or not a convert, but a follower, I should say, and that he is a follower of the hidden imam. And that is the mosque where the hidden imam disappeared from, the one that was bombed. So he thinks that Ahmadinejad is basically in a very apocalyptic frame of mind at this point. So is it possible that this could spin out of control? I mean, you said that Iran's become, we've gifted Iran, as it were. In a regional war situation, do you think it's possible that, for example, the Saudi oil would go off the market because of terrorism, and somehow Iran could stay on the market, or will the whole place become a cauldron?
I think it's very difficult to predict anything right now. One of the greatest indications of failure in the diplomatic world is when you get to a situation like this, where either because of your failed diplomacy or your no diplomacy in this case, you've gotten to a situation where, as the president is wont to say, all the options are on the table. But in fact, there are no options on the table. The only option on the table here is precision-guided strikes against whatever facilities that Iran has that we could perhaps take out and perhaps delay their nuclear program. That's getting pretty bad when those are the only options you have left. We forfeited all the other options that we might have had in the past 3 to 4 years by refusing to start any kind of strategic dialogue with Tehran. The same way we forfeited any chance with Pyongyang because we refused to start any kind of strategic dialogue that's meaningful with Pyongyang because, as the vice president might put it, we don't speak to evil.
Well, it's worth noting that the three axis of evil countries, Iran, of course, Iraq has become a different situation, but Iran and North Korea, we don't have any diplomatic relations with, and we entirely rely upon overhead photography, etc. And it seems to me that
it's abysmally inefficient.
Why don't we just take the plunge and recognize them? Whatever the trade-off is, it seems to be it would be worth having people on the ground.
Well, you're speaking in a sane way.
I won't get a job on Fox News if I keep that up.
Look at Pyongyang. I mean, we had IAEA inspectors on the ground at Yongbyon. We had the graphite rods out of the reactor there. We had eyes and ears all over the place, IAEA eyes and ears as well as others. We had South Koreans, cheek and jowl, working with the North Koreans through Kido and the light water reactor facility area where we were building the foundations and everything. We had all manner of things. Plus, the plutonium program was effectively frozen. Now, look at what we've got. Nothing. And the North Koreans are building whatever bombs they want to build at whatever speed they want to build the bombs at. That's what our diplomacy got us. That's what our refusal to talk to, quote, evil, unquote, got us. Absolutely nothing except negativity and backwards.
So if the genesis of this kind of hubristic attitude Well, let me ask you, if it's the Cheney-Rumsfeld cabal that's responsible for this guidance in terms of the president, what were they thinking? I mean, is it a personality thing? Are they sort of throwbacks to a day when we had unlimited power? I mean, this has seemed to be the great tragedy of what they've wrought, is that their impetuous and ill-conceived use of our power has undermined our strength, and if we have to withdraw from Iraq, it'll be a catastrophe for the United States in perceptual terms.
I agree. And I think you put your finger on the major criticism that I would make of this administration, besides its ineptitude, and that is that they believe American power is unlimited. Whether you look at their ahistorical and atraditional interpretation of Article II of the Constitution, or whether you look at how they feel the resolution that Congress passed and the three words, Commander-in-Chief in Article II of the Constitution enable the Commander-in-Chief to do almost anything he wants to do, whether you look at any of these things or you look at the diplomacy towards the axis of evil, you have to conclude that they believe American power is unlimited. And since it clearly is not unlimited, they have, so to speak, met their maker in the last 4 years. And that's one reason I hope David's right when he says the people who most stridently advocated this sort of concept of unlimited American power, and oh, by the way, unlimited executive power to wield that power, these people have been relegated to the woodwork. I hope David's right. I hope that the next 3 years we'll see Dick Cheney and Donald Rumsfeld heard very little of.
Well, and that's to some maybe a tall order. I mean, Henry Kissinger described Rumsfeld as one of the great bureaucratic operators of all time. It's considerable praise coming from Kissinger, and Dick Cheney, from all intents and purposes, apparently is almost in a corporate terms, he's the COO, the chief operating officer, whereas the president appears to be the chief executive officer, taking care of the shareholders, making speeches, etc. But the real levers of power seem to flow through Cheney and through Addington, his chief of staff, it used to be Libby, and through a sort of group of these like-minded lawyers that they have in key positions. And I think, isn't that the mechanism where they have bypassed the normal input from government officials?
Certainly is in the past. I like I said, I will reserve my judgment until I see results of what David is predicting. But I do note, with some caution and a bit of guarded optimism, I do note that the vice president has been unusually quiet of late, and I also note that the Secretary of Defense is becoming increasingly aware, I think, of the fact that he's presiding over what might be called the slow death of a thousand cuts of the Army and the Marine Corps. And those are real mesmerizing happenings, I think. And it's very difficult for me to imagine a man as smart as Donald Rumsfeld is and as good a bureaucratic entrepreneur, as you indicated, as Donald Rumsfeld is. Indeed, the only man to have bested Henry Kissinger not once but several times. It's hard for me to believe that he doesn't realize by now, 5 years into this, the damage he's done, and isn't searching for ways to think more about his legacy now, and isn't going to be doing things to try and rectify some of the damage he's done. And that's very time-consuming, and doesn't allow for much else besides that. So I cross my fingers, and I hope that we're going to have the next... I mean, these people have 2-3 years left to go. A lot of damage can be done in that time. And I hope beyond hope that this president has learned to moderate some of his hubris, some of his arrogance, and to depend less on those two members of administration and more on Dr. Rice and other members of the administration whose views are a hell of a lot more moderate than Rumsfeld's and Cheney's.
Just anecdotally, the CIA officer I had on last week, Bob Baer, who's the, he's the character that George Clooney plays in this movie, Syriana, that's right. out. Yeah. And he said he showed them, they showed a premiere of the movie in Washington, and the premiere was organized by the wives of the Pentagon generals, like General Casey's wife, et cetera, and that all of the top people were at the screening when it's hardly a pro-administration film. But anecdotally, he said just off the cuff that the top generals in the Pentagon had lost faith in their commander in chief. Is that something that you're hearing through the grapevine?
Well, I am hearing that there's a lot of animosity and a lot of distrust and mistrust between the what we call the civilian leadership on the third floor of the Pentagon and the military. You couldn't prove that by me with regard to the principal military officers making decisions with regard to Iraq and elsewhere, though, because what I see there in the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, the previous chairman of the Joint Chiefs, Dick Myers, and the current one, Pete Pace, what I see there is people who remind me of Vietnam military general officers who went along to get along.
Like the 5 o'clock follies syndrome. Well, just in closing, Colonel Wilkerson, given that that there obviously is some roiling going on behind the scenes, what do you think, and that you pointed out that the civilians are the ones inside the Pentagon that have been running that, and I think to cut to the chase, it's the neoconservatives. What is their future? Because, you know, one of the reasons I think that they got so emboldened was that people like Brent Scowcroft are too much of a gentleman to be shouted at on television by somebody like Cliff May. So they've, because they're skilled at TV sound bites and shouting down and filibustering, they seem to have had more play than they perhaps. I mean, these people are not written stuff. They're mostly, to me, they're mostly television scholars. So what's their fate? I mean, is there going to be some accountability here?
I would like to think so, but given our system, I doubt there will be very much that will be satisfying. I do think that one of the things they've shown from people like Richard Perle, who is head of the Defense Policy Board and then later is a sort of semi-government official, people like Douglas Feith, Paul Wolfowitz now at the World Bank, although I know Paul and used to think quite highly of him, at least his intellectual capabilities. I think these people have been exposed. And they've been exposed in a way that's going to fracture the what you might call the conservative movement. I consider myself a moderate, but probably tending towards conservative. And I know that Edmund Burke, Barry Goldwater, for that matter, would roll over in their graves if they heard these people called conservatives. They aren't conservatives. They're radicals. Whether it's Richard Perle, Douglas Feith, Dick Cheney, Donald Rumsfeld, they're not conservatives. They're radicals. They're Jacobins. And I think that's been exposed. Their physical posture is Jacobinite. They just assume bankrupt the country. Their portrayal of American values and so forth is amoral. It's atraditional. It's certainly not conservative. Their portrayal of the Constitution is not conservative. It's very radical. So I think they're going to lose a lot of ground within their own ranks, and that's the way to lose ground fast.
Well, you know, just in closing, the vice president's latest speech was in front of AIPAC, and there's always been a feeling that the neocons were tied in with the Likudniks in Israel. But how do the neocons explain that they're
think about Likud for a moment? Likud's right. About to disappear from the face of the political earth.
And I was going to say that guess what? The neocons' policies have emboldened and rewarded Iran and hardly rewarded Israel.
Worst enemy right now.
Yeah, so they haven't done much for Israel, have they?
They certainly have not, and I would dare say that the people I was hearing from in Israel back in 2001 and 2002 who were being muted at that time, that is, they were trying to say, Iraq is not the enemy, Iraq is not the enemy, Iran is, that they now have regained their voice and may be significantly influential on the new Kadima party. I would hope so. They were right.
I thank you very much for joining us in Los Angeles, Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson.
Surely.
Thank you.
Take care.
Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I'm just speaking then with Colonel Lawrence Wilkinson, who is Secretary of State Colin Powell's Chief of Staff in the Department of State from August 2002 to 2005. And as we mentioned, in October 2005, Colonel Wilkinson, after considerable soul-searching, went public to tell the uncomfortable truths that Vice President Cheney had provided, the guidance that led to America's torture, disgrace in Guantanamo, Abu Ghraib, and elsewhere, that Secretary Powell's February 2003 presentation to the United Nations Security Council was the lowest point in his life, and that U.S. foreign policy had been hijacked by the Cheney-Rumsfeld cabal. I'm now speaking with Wayne White, who is an adjunct scholar at Washington's Middle East Institute. He most recently served as the Deputy Director of the Bureau of Intelligence and Research Office of Analysis for the Near East and South Asia. Wayne White also served as the principal Iraq analyst and head of INR's Iraq team from 2003 to 2005. And as we speak, Wayne White, Iraq appears to be teetering on the cusp of a civil war. The last time we spoke was just after the elections, where you felt that, I think your quote was, game over, that rather than bringing democracy, the elections were appearing to expose the contours of a civil war. And now this, with the bombing of the mosque in Samarra, that seems to be, are we literally in this state of, somebody standing in a vat of gasoline about to strike a match?
It's hard to say, Ian. By the way, I'm glad to be on your show and glad to follow Larry, who I had a lot of very interesting times with in state, especially in the fall of 2004 into 2005.
By the way, Wayne, did you catch the earlier part where Colonel Wilkinson felt that he was talking to David Rothkopf, or he's quoting David Rothkopf's piece in today's Washington Post, saying that he felt that Cheney and Rumsfeld were on their way out and that Rice would reassert itself?
Well, I'd hope so, but I just don't see any change, going on there. And part of the reason that these people keep surviving and even getting the numbers they have now, I mean, people are talking about the falling poll numbers, but I think they're doing better than they should. That the numbers should have been way down long ago, and part of it is because they dumb down these issues, such as misusing a word that I get upset about all the time, as I was listening to Don Rumsfeld in Washington, where I was making a few appearances last week, and that is Iraqis. I'm constantly hearing Iraqis won't stand for X. Iraqis believe Y. Who are these Iraqis? Iraqis are Shia, Sunni, Kurds. They think differently. They have conflicting interests in many cases. And to not face up to the fact, as actually our ambassador is, Zalmay Khalilzad, when he's trying to get Shia to make concessions to Sunni, etc., to not face up to this fact is a real, real blind spot. But it may also be political in the sense that to the extent that they can dumb it down and make it sound easy to American voters, they can basically dodge some of the logic, of what's happening over there. Civil war? The only problem with civil war is what kind of a civil war we're talking about, because I think a lot of people are arguing over civil war, believing that maybe it's like our civil war or the Russian civil war after 1918, or where armies are marching up and down the country and everything. And I think the Beirut-type model is what we're talking about here, and I think there is a lot of gasoline around.
Well, that's a particularly depressing analogy, because that destroyed that country, and it still hasn't recovered to the extent that the dominant party there are the Iranian-backed Hezbollah. And even now, with the death of Hariri and the following on, there's still some doubts as to whether that's going to even hold together. So,
oh, absolutely. I think democracy is a very hard sell in these fractured societies who've never had experience before in it, and who often have been suffering under autocrats for decades, even generations. I just talked to somebody who's a very, very good observer of the situation in Beirut, who had just come back and said that she was shocked at the change from a year ago, when there was a lot of somewhat naive hope on the street about the sort of bursting forth of democracy, and now people talking, you know, Shia talking about Sunnis and Sunnis talking about Christians in terms that were much, very much like that what she heard during the Civil War, you know, period, that hostilities were now coming out, you know, in Lebanon. We've got the same situation, you know, in Iraq. There are a lot of glib neocons, by the way, who will tell you, so what if Iraq breaks up? You know, all them the Sunnis do what they want, Sunni Arabs and the Kurds do what they want, and the Shia do what they want, but that doesn't work in Iraq, because maybe 20 or 25% of the populated areas of the country are mixed, and Baghdad's mixed, just like Beirut was mixed, and you can have Baghdad looking like Beirut, you know, a few years down the road.
Well, already there is footage from Baghdad of Shia moving out of predominantly Sunni areas and vice versa. I mean, people with their mattresses on their backs getting the hell out. So that does sort of give you the sense of a portent. What about Secretary Rumsfeld's charges before the Appropriations Committee this week in the United States Senate, saying that the Jerusalem Brigade of the Revolutionary Guards of Iran were now in the Shia areas? I mean, first of all, that seems to be a pretty damning admission on the extent to which the Shia part of Iraq has been penetrated by Iran.
Well, there's something that worries me very, very greatly, and that is that we may be on track for another war with Iran. The Quds Force, which actually it acts more as an intelligence and, you know, paramilitary operation, you know, and operates in small units, you know, sort of like, you know, a brigade wouldn't be there, like 3,000 people doing this and that. They'd be there in little packets of 5 and 10 doing this and doing that. The Quds Force is probably the most nefarious element of Iran's intelligence, you know, apparatus. It's a very dangerous, you know, black ops, you know, organization, and they've been there from the get-go. I mean, they were in there after the fall of Baghdad, you know, working in there. But the thing that I really worry about is that since they've been in there all that time and nobody said anything about it, it basically comes into a lot of other rhetoric that has been heightening recently about Iran and the nuclear issue. And, you know, we're not going to let them get the, you know, the bomb, et cetera. And, you know, I don't want that to happen either. And the Iranians are certainly not good guys. But I'm very, very nervous about somebody taking on Iran, a country that's 2.5 times the size of Iraq with a population of 70 million people. You take on Iran and you've got some real issues to discuss.
But surely, I think that one of the problems we have with this impetuous, immature use of American power that's so manifestly undermined this country's strength is that we're in danger of being perceived as a paper tiger because nobody takes us seriously. Everybody knows we're bogged down and paralyzed in Iraq. So how could you even threaten Iran and make that threat credible?
Well, I have a feeling, I think you're quite right, and if we took on the Iranians, since we would not be talking about some airstrikes and then it's over, the Iranians like to pay you back, and they have a lot of ways of doing that, we could find ourselves even more overstretched, you know, because of getting ourselves deeply bogged down in something almost akin to a war with Iran. I think a lot of people don't take it all in. You know, the Iranians have the nuclear sites that are vastly dispersed. That requires a huge strike package. They also are vastly well defended by anti-aircraft. They've learned a lot from what happened to the Iraqis. So then you need more strike package. Then they can hit you in the Gulf with surface-to-surface missiles fired at fleet units, et cetera. So what do you do? Take that out, too. If you start walking this back, the package, the task gets larger and larger and larger. And, of course, Iran, meanwhile, is painting itself into a corner, almost driving its own head into the noose because of the anti-Semitic rants, you know, of its former Revolutionary Guard president, its refusal today to accept the Russian offer you know, to have enrichment take place outside of the country. We seem to be on a collision course here. We seem to see administration rhetoric driving higher and higher toward potential war with Iran, and the Iranians basically giving it back.
Well, of course, they've said, their foreign minister said in terms of the IAEA referral to the Security Council that let the ball roll, somewhat echoing President Bush's ill-fated statement about bring them on.
Yeah.
And then, of course, the U.S. side is talking about, well, you've got two weeks before the hammer comes down, or whatever the veiled implication there was with that ultimatum. So, and I have to add to this, Wayne White, apparently the Iranian leader, he is an apocalyptic follower of the hidden imam. And it was the tomb where the hidden imam disappeared was the one that was blown up. And apparently, from what Bob Baer, the CIA officer, last week told me, that this guy is in an extremely apocalyptic mindset.
Now, I think there, regardless of what his mindset is, and it's unclear, but I've seen a lot to support what you're saying, he's a very dangerous man. Fortunately, in the Iranian system, he doesn't have a lot of power. As we saw in the previous reformist president, who we were hoping would succeed, he had the entire parliament on his side, the local councils, himself in the presidency, and he couldn't make any headway. And so this guy isn't running the show, but his rhetoric is unbelievable, and the refusal of the Russian offer wholesale leaves very little wiggle room, you know, to escape with a diplomatic solution. I was at a, I gave a talk at Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, last week, and after it, the Russian political counselor from the Russian embassy walked up to me, and I told him, I said, you're the solution. I said, you need to step up to the plate. I said, send back to Moscow the message, you know, that you need to tell the Iranians that if they do not accept your deal, particularly with the ranting, you know, of an irresponsible, potentially dangerous president, and particularly in view of what the world community is uniting around, we are no longer going to support your program. That's it, period. And if that were done, the Chinese walked and took their aspect of the nuclear cooperation away. If that happened, the Iranians would be in really, in real deep water. And I hope the Russians can step up to the plate. I see no other solution to this.
Well, if there is an apocalyptic element to this, and you said that, I mean, Najad doesn't have the clout that obviously Khamenei, the spiritual leader, did go public this week, and he's seemed just as hardline as the Ahmadinejad. So if there's a civil war in Iraq, and if the Quds group that are in there fomenting trouble, if somehow that's precipitated, I can't see how a civil war in Iraq could not be a regional war, given that the Shia populations inhabit the Gulf, Bahrain is majority Shia, and the Saudi oil fields are. The prospect for sabotage is so great, I can't imagine that not happening. So I guess my question is, if the Iranians are not totally nihilistic, is there a scenario whereby they could punish the West, punish the Saudi and the Gulf, and somehow still keep pumping oil? Or would the Straits of Hormuz be automatically closed if there's a regional war?
I think that, you know, that's the problem is that, no, I don't think you could keep the oil flowing if things got really out of control in the Gulf. In fact, the Iraq and Iran situations could meld in a certain way. In other words, a wounded Iran with her facilities, nuclear facilities smashed, air defenses shattered, and things like that could easily lash out, for example, by mobilizing its Basij or mobilization army that fought heavily in the Iran-Iraq War and its Revolutionary Guard forces, and just hurl them across the border into a chaotic Iraq with an undefended border in support of the Shia community. At least they could say that that's what they were doing, when in fact they were going after us. and others. It's a very dangerous situation. And
well, it's pretty bad for us, though, isn't it?
Oh, awful. And one naive scenario, one naive thing I hear all the time is, well, you see, the Sunni Arabs can't really have a civil war because they have no oil. If we get to a civil war scenario in Iraq, believe me, the Sunni Arab states of Jordan, Saudi Arabia, Egypt, the UAE, Kuwait, they will fund, they will provide everything that the Sunni Arabs need to fight. And the Sunni Arabs, in that community, you have the most military expertise in the country and basically almost the entire former officer corps, you know, of the army. So they will fight hard and they will get what they want. And to the extent that happens, Iran has to be sucked in order to support its Shia, you know, compatriots in there, and will, of course, be doing what you are also saying. As these Gulf states support the Sunni Arabs in Iraq, they will be, Iran will be trying to retaliate by inciting Shia populations in their own countries, like in the Saudi Eastern province. You're right.
And the Sunni military leadership that you refer to are already the brains behind the insurgency, and you're just saying that they'll get some really heavy weapons.
That's exactly what I'm saying, that if things, if push comes to shove and we get into a full-blown, you know, settling out of affairs, yes, they will need more than just, you know, some guns or, you know, rifles, machine guns, hand grenades and whatever. They will need tanks, APCs, artillery, and they will probably get it. If the Shia have it, the Kurds have it, they'll get it.
Well, just in closing, Wayne White, what if this, if any of these scenarios, even in part, take place, you would think it should be enough to run Rumsfeld and Cheney out of town. And if Larry Wilkinson is right, that they're on their way out. Although he did, perhaps there's some wishful thinking on his part there, but the long and the short of it is, when is this going to be some accountability? Because one of the things that I find mystifying about the Democrats and the so-called opposition in this country is, for reasons that mystify me, the Democrats have made George Bush's mistake their problem. So we don't even have an alternative narrative out there.
Exactly. And there's a supreme irony in all this, that essentially this neocon clique has screwed up the situation, let's say just one, Iraq. There are other things they've done. They've screwed it up so bad that it's very hard to find a solution to it. And so it's very hard for somebody else to oppose them with a definitive program. I talked to somebody on the Curry campaign just recently who was sitting with John Curry between one of his campaign stops. And this was somebody who worked, you know, foreign policy issues. And they just happened to be discussing Iraq. And you remember Curry was criticized for flip-flopping on Iraq. And it's just what I thought it was. They couldn't think of a way out. And in fact, this one campaigner actually looked over to John Curry and said, "Do we really want to win?" Now, of course, it was rhetorical, but that showed how troubled they were in trying to find an alternative.
Well, remember what Senator Claude Aiken said about Vietnam? How do you get out of Vietnam? He said, by boat.
Well, I just heard another person say something that's also true, and that is our choice in Iraq, it put in Vietnam, you know, chronology, is basically, do you want to get out in 1968 or do you want to get out in 1974?
Well, thanks so much for joining us, Wayne White. We're going to get another opinion on the Iranian situation here. So I thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you too, Ian.
Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I'm speaking then with Wayne White, who is an adjunct scholar at the Washington Middle East Institute, and he's recently served as the Deputy Director of the Bureau of Intelligence and Research at the State Department, where he's also the head of INR's Iraq team from 2003 to 2005. I'm now speaking with Dr. Mohammed Sahimi, who's a professor and chairman of chemical engineering at the University of Southern California. He was educated in Iran and the United States and has been a faculty member at USC since 1984. In January of this year, Dr. Sahimi wrote a Los Angeles Times op-ed article with the 2003 Nobel Peace Prize laureate Shirin Ebadi entitled "Diffusing Iran with Democracy." And Dr. Sahimi, in that article, you imply, correct me if I'm wrong, that Iran's referral to the IAEA and the Security Council deliberations, which I believe will end in a couple of weeks, and as our previous guest mentioned, apparently Iran turned down the face-saving Russian offer, which has essentially always been on the table. Is there a way at this moment then to translate this situation into leverage for democracy in Iran?
Definitely, we can help Iranian democratic forces, Iranian reformist forces within Iran, who have been outspoken about some of the policies of the government of President Ahmadinejad regarding Iran's nuclear issue, and they have been criticizing it. There are ways of helping them to move Iran towards democracy. At the same time, you mentioned that Iran rejected Russia's proposal. But I must say that Russia's proposal, in the way that it has been presented here in this country, is not what it is actually is. The Russian proposal actually has changed over time. First, Russia offered Iran to invest in Russia's enrichment program and also have access to the technology. That proposal was seriously considered by Iran, and they were going actually to accept it. Then they changed it and then said that, well, you invest in our enrichment program, but you don't have any access to technology and you don't have any control on its management. So that is a dramatic change from the original proposal, and that was, of course, not accepted by the Iranian government. The Iranian government made a sort of a counter proposal whereby Iran would get its enriched uranium from Russia in return for having a small-scale enrichment research and development within Iran. And by a small, I mean so small that it cannot actually be used for producing enriched uranium for, let's say, making a nuclear bomb. But the Western powers, the European countries and the United States, are totally opposed to Iran having any sort of enrichment program. So that's why we are at the impasse that we are. But as Dr. Abadi and I discussed in the article that you mentioned that was published in Los Angeles Times and International Herald Tribune, there are many ways that we can help democratic forces, reformist forces in Iran to move Iran towards democracy, which I believe is the ultimate solution to Iran's nuclear energy program. For example, we can allow Iranian scholars, students, authors, writers, other intellectuals come to the United States, have cultural exchanges, exchanges on political situation, discuss all important matters. We can have discussions and relations between Iran's labor union and labor unions in this country. So there are all sorts of ways that we can foster democracy in Iran. Another way that Western powers can help democracy in Iran is by opposing any sort of sanction against Iran. I am against any sort of sanctions, because sanctions ultimately only hurt ordinary people and not the people that sanctions are supposed to be targeting. But if there is going to be any sanction, I can see that we can have at least intelligence sanctions, whereby we just sanction, let's say, sale of things that can be used for making weapons, but there is no reason, for example, for Iran not to be able to buy civilian aircraft from the United States or Western European countries, because its civilian airlines have been old and have been crashing one after another. And these are the things that would create a very good feelings among Iranian people towards the West, towards the United States and Western European countries. Iranian people are already very much pro-Western countries, but at the same time, because of its long history and because of its ancient civilization, there's a strong sense of nationalism among Iranian people. They don't like outside power to come into Iran and try to interfere in Iran's domestic affairs. And at the same time, they would like to have good, cordial relationship with every country, including Western European countries and the United States. So there are many, many things that can be done to foster democracy in Iran, which, as I mention again, it is the ultimate solution to Iran's nuclear energy program.
And Dr. Sahimi, Ahmadinejad, the leader, obviously is playing the nationalism card because it apparently is popular. And our earlier guest mentioned that neither he nor his predecessor appear to have any real power. And that seems to be the problem with the fact that the Supreme Leader seems to wield the ultimate power. And the question is then, I mean, an earlier guest, Lawrence Wilkinson, felt that it was indeed counterintuitive for us not to recognize Iran, as is the case with the other axis of evil country, North Korea, that we pay a terrible price for not having a dialogue with these countries. That, of course, is in this current environment, is a complete fantasy to think that the United States is going to suddenly recognize Tehran. But in fact, what's really happening is that there is a war of words that is extremely inflammatory. The United States is making belligerent statements. Cheney spoke before the AIPAC, the Israeli lobby, this week. The Iranian foreign minister said, let the ball roll. Now our spokespeople are saying you've got a couple of weeks before the showdown. So, and apparently I understand from the bombing of the Samarra Mosque that really did affect Ahmadinejad, who has an apocalyptic mindset. So the truth of the matter is, on the landscape out there, things seem to be spinning out of control.
Yes, I mean, let's put ourselves in Iranian leaders' shoes, regardless of how we feel about them. I agree that President Ahmadinejad is a sort of a radical person, but let's put ourselves in their shoes. Whatever they hear coming out of Washington or Western European countries is just threat against Iran's national security. So what are they going to do? They are going to counteract, and they are going to say, if you're going to harm us, we also have the capability to harm you.
Well, that's exactly what they said.
Exactly. So what I'm trying to say is that this is not a one-way street where only Iranian leaders are just threatening, let's say, the United States or Western European countries. In fact, they are not threatening them. What they are saying is that if you try to harm us, if you try to attack us, we can also harm you. We can also inflict damage on you. And the fact of the matter is, Iran does have a lot of leverage in the Middle East and can counter any military move by the United States or Israel against Iran. Iran has a lot of influence in Iraq and can create huge trouble for U.S. forces in Iraq. Iran has many allies among Muslim groups throughout the Middle East. Iran controls the entire Persian Gulf and Oman Sea, the most important route for transferring Middle East oil to the rest of the world. And Iran does have relatively good conventional forces and also equipped with missiles that can reach several countries in the Middle East. So it is not that they are defenseless. When you add that and couple that to Iranians' a strong sense of nationalism and their pride in their history and their culture and glorious civilization, then you will see that regardless of whether you are a religious radical or a reformist or a Democrat, you don't like what you hear coming out of Washington. When Vice President of the United States goes in front of the most important and the most powerful lobbying group in the United States, namely the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, which is nothing but an arm of the Israeli government in the United States to advance the interests of the Israeli government and Israeli nation, and it speaks about painful consequences for Iran, what do we expect Iranian leader to say? Do we expect them to say, yes, sir, just come here and do whatever you want? Of course, they're going to counteract. They're going to respond, and they're going to ratchet up the rhetorical war. So we have to be very careful about what we say, because radicals on both sides, we have radicals not only in Iran, we also have radicals among Bush administration, among neoconservatives, that have already completely messed up Iraq, but they don't give up their fantasies about changing overnight the Middle East into a heaven for democracy. And these radicals are pushing for a new war against Iran. And so we have to be very, very careful about this. At the same time, I must emphasize that some of the comments that President Ahmadinejad has made regarding, for example, Israel, They are deplorable, of course, and they have been condemned even in Iran by people across the political spectrum, but they have also been blown out of proportion. Because as you mentioned, the ultimate decisions regarding Iran's national security affairs and Iran's foreign policy are not made by Iranian president. They are made by Iran's supreme leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei. And Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, regardless of how we feel about him and what his domestic policies are regarding democracy and human rights within Iran, has shown himself to be a cool, calculating person. He is well aware of the fact that any real threat against U.S. allies in the Middle East will provoke a very massive retaliation by the United States and its allies against Iran. So he's not a sort of a crazy, radical person who is going to take any action or any threat. So the comments by President Ahmadinejad are just rhetorics. That's what they are. And this is just like you said, this is a war of words between the two countries. So anything that comes out of Washington or Western Europe will be responded by Iranian leaders. And quite frankly, we should expect it because this is a war of words and they are not going to back down.
Well, just in closing, Dr. Sahimi, what do you make then of the fact that the Revolutionary Guards group, the Al-Quds group, the Jerusalem Brigade, are in Rumsfeld has admitted that they're inside Iraq. Is that just the leverage we're talking about in the ability to cause us pain if we try and cause them pain? I mean, the thing that I worry about is that even though none of this makes any sense on the surface, that doesn't mean, I'm reminded of Barbara Tuchman's book about World War One, The March of Folly. When these two countries are on this collision course, it doesn't take much to spin it out of control, and it almost happened a couple of weeks ago with the bombing at the mosque in Samarra.
Well, let me say that the comments by Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld are astonishing. They are astonishing because of the simple fact that Iran and its leader have been greatly influential in trying to get the Shiite parties to work with the Sunnis and Kurds and preventing Iraq from falling into a full-blown civil war. The United States is well aware of the fact that Iran has helped the situation. Iran has tried to talk to Shiite groups, including the group led by Muqtada Sadr. Iran has been talking to the leaders of the Supreme Council for Islamic Revolution in Iraq. And these are the groups that actually have cooperated with U.S. and British forces in Iraq in trying to calm down the situation. And at the same time, Mr. Rumsfeld has been making these sort of outrageous accusations about how Iran has tried to infiltrate Iraq and has been sending people across the border to try to agitate things. But he has never presented any shred of evidence. And in fact, the United States has authorized our ambassador to Iraq, Mr. Zalmay Khalilzad, to talk to Iranian people, to talk to Iranian leaders, in order to try to defuse the critical situation that we have in Iraq. And Iran has been very helpful. So when I read or hear comments like those made by Donald Rumsfeld, they just seem to me to be pure propaganda. And then because the facts on the ground speak for themselves, and they are totally opposite to what Donald Rumsfeld is saying.
Well, I'm afraid we've run out of time, but I definitely want to stay in touch with you, Dr. Mohammed Sahimi, since this situation does appear to be at a critical juncture, and it could, as I say, tip into disaster. I thank you so much for joining us.
I'll be delighted to participate again.
Thank you. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I've just spoken with Dr. Mohammed Sahimi, who's Professor and Chairman of the Chemical Engineering Department at the University of Southern California. Dr. Sahimi wrote, along with the 2003 Nobel Prize laureate Shirin Ebadi, an article recently in the Los Angeles Times. And I also thank my producer, Louis Vandenberg, Jay Shepard, the engineer, Rusty Wynn, the associate producer, Carol Kuth, the assistant producer.